Lions in the Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue.
Welcome to Two Pints in the Corner with Tony Rain and Dinky Dawson. Tony is out right now getting well and everything from illness over the last few months. And so it's just myself. Peter Limbo's not with us, or Tim Miller's not with us just today. It's what we're doing is talking to Doug Winicky, who worked with me at the Channel and in Necco Place, which is a little place next door, and also an installation in New York City. And I would love to say, welcome, Doug Winicky, to Two Pints in a Corner.
Thank you, Dickie. Hello, everyone.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome. You're welcome to see. So, Doug, first question from me is, if I remember rightly, you came in to the club with a band originally. And I was impressed, and you were impressed on trying to do what the sound and this, that, and the other, working on electronics, more to do with the technical side, but still working on the sound and stuff like that. Is that right? Am I right about that?
Yeah, I was thinking that, first of all, thank you for giving me a week's notice, because this allowed me to, you know, spend the week kind of immersing myself back in that time, because you don't normally go deeply into your past. But, you know, it's when you texted me last week, it was just like old times. It's like,
that's right.
I need you on Thursday. Can you fill on Thursday? I mean, you don't say no today.
that was why I said, okay, get your brain going. And it really does open up some things that were really fantastic for you. And all of us. So let's get them down and have a chat about them.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'm glad that you and Tony and Peter are doing this, because this is really important to capture these things. And, you know, as well, it's not so much that time goes on that you realize, you know, during that time, I realized, you know, I knew that it was a special time. And, you know, working at the Channel was, you know, the biggest, best, most prestigious music venue in not only Boston, but the New England area. During a decade, a classic decade of music in the 1980s. And, you know, it's just something that it's people that, you know, have either attended shows there or even just want to, you know, revisit that music era. I think we'll find this interesting. Like, I don't have any, like, dirt on the Channel Club, right? I don't have any salacious rock and roll stories as it relates to the Channel. You know, it's not that, you know, I don't want to talk about it or I shouldn't talk about it. I simply don't, right?
But you remember stories. The first thing is the question about...
Oh, no,
You know, who did you come in with originally? Do you remember?
Well, you know, what I could do is give you what it was like day to day as a house sound engineer at that Channel. I think it would be good to just back up, because, you know, working with the Channel, working with you, Dinky, I always kind of viewed it as a, you know, as a Cinderella story. You know, I came to Boston in 19. So I worked at the Channel from about 3.5 to 4 years in the span of from 1986 to 1990.
That was it. 1986, you came in. That's right.
And it's actually 39 years ago to the month. So it was June.
Yeah.
So it's bringing back so many memories. I think it would be good for me to just spend a couple of minutes leading up to how I got to the situation where I met you.
Yeah, that sounds good. Go for it.
Because it's a fun story. So I arrived in September of 1982. I was 18 years old at Berklee College of Music. I'd, you know, come off of a year at Queens College. I'm originally from Long Island, New York. And, you know, piano and composition was my thing. And I came from a good East Islip High School, had a really good music program. It was well known all over the island. So I was really blessed, in, you know, growing up in that environment. I mean, they had a full stage that would rival Broadway. I mean, you know, big stage of multiple winches with, so you can lower and raise the flats and change the scenery. And they had national acts that would come in to offset some of the costs. Like I remember Maynard Ferguson, the trumpet player, and Buddy Rich, the drummer, playing there. So coming out of that, and, you know, I was steeped in, you know, classical piano training, had a lot of experience playing on stage. So I went to a Queens College, their music program, the Aaron Copland School of Music. And after a year of that, I would commute on the Long Island Expressway and work at the family grocery store in Hempstead on the way back. So I was always going to school and always having a side gig to, you know, for extra money, because, you know, I grew up with the family business. And when I heard about Berklee, I was like, gee, you know, I hear about, you know, I can study jazz. Like, I didn't have a whole lot of jazz, you know, growing up and in high school. And, you know, I heard about the synthesis program. So it was just modern music. So I transferred over to Berklee. And so in September of 86, I was 18 years old and was in the dorms in 150 Massachusetts Avenue on the corner of Mass Ave and Boylston. And one of the first things I did was get a job at Star Market, the grocery store that was at the base of the Prudential Tower.
That's right. I remember
that. Because, you know, it was natural. I needed spending money. Like, you know, I couldn't think of, like, hitting up my parents for money. It's like getting into the school and into the dorms was enough. And all the rest of the, you know, my buddies in the dorms, you know, none of them worked. I think one other guy was a dishwasher at a restaurant. So they all kind of made fun of me. I came home with a Star Market Spock and things, but I don't care. Laugh at them because I had spending money. Well, my two roommates in the dorms, they were enrolled in the music production and engineering department at Berklee. And I was like, what's that? And they're talking about, oh, well, you know, you have recording studios, you get to work the mixing board, and, you know, you record records. And that just, the light bulb went off of me. It's like, that's it. You know, that's what I want to do. Because that's really, you know, I didn't want to study music for the sake of music or classical jazz or anything. I wanted to do what, you know, all those vinyl records that I wore holes in when I was a kid. Because that's all I did was buy records, you know. Yeah. And so I rolled in the program, and by, I'd say, 1984, so about a year and a half later, I'm starting to get the bug. Like, I really love this. I was just completely engrossed in, you know, the equipment and the signal routing and the 2-inch tapes and tape editing and such. It's like, I want to start doing this. So I went down to, I was in the recording studios, which was deep in the basement of 150 Mass Ave underneath the dorms. That's where they had all the recording studios, which makes sense because of the isolation and such. And they had a bulletin board there. And, you know, at the time, that's how everything happened. You know, these cork bulletin boards was how, you know, band members got together to form bands, sell equipment. Every place had these bulletin boards, schools, colleges, pizza places, bars, clubs. And, you know, if the venue, if the establishment didn't have the board, people would start just taping things to the wall or to the glass. And so these businesses had to eventually buy a board because they didn't want their, you know, paint getting peeled off.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's either that or the Boston Phoenix taking out an ad. But on that bulletin board was, you know, looking for an intern at a recording studio. And I'm like, that's it. So, it was a downtown studio called Pyramid Recording,
yep.
Pyramid Studios. Anybody who's been, you know, in the business at the time would know Gene Bodio. He was the owner and engineered so many classic Boston bands at the time. And so I was working, and suddenly I was like a star. All my buddies were like, "Wow, you're working at Pyramid?" I'm like, "Yeah." "Wow, can you get me in there?" So. Mind you, I'm still at the grocery store part-time. I got, you know, going to Berklee full-time. Now I got this. And, you know, having time for, like, a girlfriend or spending time with my friends. So, you know, I was pretty busy. And that's a whole nother story, working on the Live Aid session, you know, the Who We Are the World time, the Africa Aid. Stu Kimball face to face. He was producing some records, but that's a whole nother story. But that's how I got into audio. And mind you, when I came in 86, acoustic piano was all I really knew. I put in a guitar cord into someone's amp when I had to play a synthesizer in the garage band or something. I never had an amp, so I knew nothing. So, I'm assisting in the recording studio, and, I'm holding my own, because I have practical experience out, from just basic recording, classroom. I also had some, real hands-on, experience as, in jobs. So, I had that going for me too, but I had, I really didn't know what I was doing other than the classes I took at Berkeley. But I survived. And by the time 86 rolled around, so I've been, interning for a year, year and a half, but I started getting another bug. It's like, I wasn't getting the recording studio engineer position that I thought might happen. Because I found out it didn't work that way. When bands came to Pyramid, either they had their own engineer and producer, or Gene Bodio got the gig. So I'm like, I gotta get a band to record. Because I was also thinking, if I can get into a studio, maybe have some free studio time, I could record some of my own stuff. So I had a friend from the Fenway area, that we had apartments there, Dickie Spears. And he was setting up a studio in Jamaica Plain called Squid Hell. And he had a friend that needed a live sound guy. Like, okay. And at that time, I realized that that would be the only way really to get involved with bands, to be able to maybe represent and get a gig recording somebody's record. So I knew that the live sound was going to be the only way I could, that's the next avenue to explore. But all I knew was from the perspective from musicians, and they all told me, like, oh, yeah, all those house sound guys, they're just jerks. What? You go there, they're all, they don't care. They're set up for a sound check. You go, you play for 45 seconds, and then they, all right, that's enough. And, they're like, they don't care about the music. They're just there for the club to make money. Now, that's what was fed into me. And it was like, oh, yeah, definitely, I understand. So that was, my understanding of what it was like to do, shows at a music club. Like, all right. So since I had, all of this employment history, guess what? I had access to credit. So I bought all this gear thinking, okay, I'll have my own gear. So I bought a Rev 7, Yamaha Rev 7 reverberator, Tascam 4-track, and was just going to set up my own home studio. Built a patch bay out of mini jacks and curtain rods. I still have that thing, too. But I had, a little home studio. And then what I did is I went down to my parents. My dad had a workshop. And because I needed a case, and I didn't have any more money. I was already, my God, it must have been $850 in 1986 when I bought the Rev 7.
Yeah.
And then I got Apple credit, bought a Macintosh Plus. That was another $2,600. So I was, they were all happy to give me the, the financing. But anyway, I was just, this is the route to go. So I went with the band, went to the rehearsals, get some cues, know the music. So they booked first two shows. This was a band called One Nation. Will Overstreet was a singer-songwriter, and he was starting out with this band. And my friend Dick Spears had already been recording and such. So it was going to work out. So they had the first two shows booked was The Beachcomber, I believe it was called The Beachcomber in Wollaston.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then The Channel. Now, The Channel I had already been to. So the first time I went to The Channel was 1983, because in the dorms, a friend of mine, Pete Jock, fantastic musician, bass player, he was playing in a band called Liquid Trance. And when it was known that they had to get the channel, it was like, okay, all hands on deck. Right? And I was like, what's the channel? I don't know. What's the channel? And a lot of those guys were from New England. I mean, Berkeley attracted everyone from around the world. But a lot of those guys were from New England, you know, Western Mass, Rhode Island, New Hampshire and Southern. And so they're like, you don't know the channel? I'm like, no. And it's like, oh, it's just the biggest, you know, thing. When you play there, you know, if you can draw a good crowd, you're on your way to making. Right? Oh, okay. Couldn't wait. So it was all hands on deck, helping them in there. And so my earliest recollection of being at the channel was in the spring of 83 when they played. And I could still have a mental image of being, you know, in the front in what we call the pit,
yeah,
in front of the stage. So that was my first exposure to the channel. And it was, you know, I do remember that. I was pretty blown away because other than that, it was like the small clubs. Like there was a club called Jumping Jack Flash in the Fenway. It was, you know, typical, you know, music club, small, maybe 100, 120 capacity. I saw Till Tuesday there, Amy Mann, before they hit it big. So that's what, you know, I knew of music clubs. So when I saw the channel, I was like, wow, okay, yeah, you're right. And so the Beachcomber, and then there was going to be the channel. Like, oh, boy. So mind you, it's like it's been 2 years since I came to Boston and only plugged in a guitar plug in an amp. I mean, that's how green it was. And, you know, a lot of these guitar players that, you know, play rock bands, you know, they operated PA systems, you know, public address systems and signal routing and everything. I had, you know, no knowledge when I came in 82. So here I am. I've got two sound gigs. I've got my rack. And I built this thing with, you know, like I said, it was in my dad's basement. I got some 3/4-inch thin plywood.
Yeah.
And then these gray angle irons with the holes that you still get them, real heavy gauge metal.
Yeah.
And, you know, cut it up. So, you know, this thing must have weighed 20 to 25 pounds, you know, just empty. So it was a beast. But I, you know, I didn't have any money for a nice case. So that first show, there was no sound check, I remember, and it went horribly. And it was horribly because it was too loud, or they couldn't hear the vocals, they couldn't hear this, couldn't hear that, and it was my fault. Yeah, it just felt terrible because, you know, this band is rehearsing, they're trying to get going, and they, you know, they want to get a sound guy with them, and I'm like, oh. And then I was faced with the channels the next show. So keep in mind, I've got it in my head that, you know, you go to these clubs, these sound guys, you know, they're jerks. They're going to, you know, they're not going to help you out. And then, so, you know, as our, you know, sound engineer, you got to represent us. You got to kind of buffer us from that. Be our advocate. I got you. I've got people skills. I understand. So it was a new music night. And I come in with, you know, my gear. I have this, you know, metal handle on it. And the front and back, I've got these, you know, basic hardware hinges and class. I did paint it black, so it wasn't like a wood plywood box. But so, you know, this guy in charge there, he's got the goatee and the cap, and he's got this, you know, heavy British accent. So not thick. Like I can understand what he's saying, but it introduced yet another level of intimidation. Because you know the old adage, like, you know, when Americans hear a British accent, they all get intimidated, right? And there's a lot to be said for that because, you know, music was my thing. And, you know, British invasion, pretty much in the 1960s, you know, the British acts, they came in pretty much, you know, laid stake to at least a third of the music scene in America. So you got that going for you in big city club. I'm like, okay. And the one thing is, like, it was just like kneeling. Like, come on, we got to get this going. You don't leave that there. You guys got to have sound. You guys got to get your first sound within 3 minutes. Like, okay. And, you know, he was, you know, talking to the band, like, you guys got to hurry it up a little bit. I'm like, okay. And something was said, right? And you said something. I don't remember what it was, but I was like, okay, I'm going to stake, you know, my position and push back. And so I snapped back at you. I don't remember what it was about. It was probably something like, you know, well, you told me to put it over here, and now you told me to put it over there, something like that. And I just I released the frustration. So then, you know, there was a pall for me, you know. And, you know, you dealt with it as you would. And we got through the soundtrack. And what would happen was New Music Nights, you'd have your sound checks, and then you'd have your lull before the doors would open. And so I remember standing by, like, the corral just when you walk through the front door with that bar to the left. So I was in that area because I didn't know what else to do because the DJ music is playing and we're just waiting for the doors open. So the Englishman comes walking over to me. And I'm like, okay, this is uncomfortable. And he comes up to me and says, can I have a word with you outside, please? And my heart sunk. I'm like, oh, no. Now I'm going to get it. Here it is, like, you know, I was kind of like blamed for the first show. I was like, you know, it wasn't really fair because there was no sound check and it was a small room. And you need more experience with small rooms than big rooms, actually. And now I've already blown the relationship for the band because I'm essentially representing the band. So I'm like, oh, I'm going to get it. And it was just, you know, whatever feeling where, you know, you're caught and you're going to get a spanking, you know. And, you know, Dinky was, you know, you're an intimidating figure, you know. Plus, you know, you were in good shape. You know, you weren't like a muscle-bound gymnast, but, you know.
Nope.
You know, from all those, you know, load in, load out of heavy cabinets, moving them around and things, and just being on your feet.
Yeah.
So we walked outside the front door. Outside of the overhang to the left as you face it, I know it distinctly. And I was just like, I expected, look, you know, you don't pull that attitude on me. When you're here, if you do is just say, you guys are never going to come back here. I was expecting that kind of confrontation. But what I got was, I was wondering if you'd be available, if you'd be interested in working some nights here at the club for me.
Yeah.
And then, like, I mean, you could have said, gee, can I give you a kiss? And I would have been still as same as blown away as that. I'm like, that is not what I expected. Now, mind you, I was still working part-time at the grocery store. And I'm living in Back Bay and Fence. And I'm thinking about at that time, you know, myself and a roommate, we paid $250, $275 a month for an apartment in Gainsborough Street, which was, you know, 100 yards from Symphony Hall.
Yeah.
And I remember nights, you know, sitting and looking out the bay window and seeing a beautiful view of the Prudential Tower lit up at night. All of that on a part-time grocery store salary. I looked up this morning. Those units are like between $700 and $1.2 million.
Yeah.
It's just, when I think about, you know, what was offered to me as far as opportunity, I'm just glad I took advantage of all of it. So that was summer of 80, June of 86. And, you know, you brought me in, we did some nights together. And the first Saturday night was the next milestone. It's like, okay, Dougie, I'm going to give you a Saturday, like, all by myself. Because I had already run like a New Music Night, or I think Thursdays was metal night.
Yeah.
So, you know, you had me working next to you for, you know, the first couple of weeks. New Music showed me all the equipment, where everything is stored, and, you know, kind of observed how I worked and such. And first Saturday night was in August. And I looked it up online because you can see some of the shows, what was the schedule in the channel. But sometime in August was my first Saturday night was Extreme.
Oh yeah.
So, and you know, on those nights, you know, the thing is with the channel, anybody remember, you know, being there when it was empty, you know, it didn't sound very good because, you know, you're talking about cinder block walls, these metal trusses, like a warehouse with corrugated metal roof. So everything was reflective. You've got on the floor was these linoleum black tiles with like diamond dust patterns.
Oh, yes, that's right. I remember
that. I don't know why I remembered that, but I mean, it was just a product of this past week, just digging through my head what I remember. But when the soundtrack was going on, it was very difficult. And by the time the show went on and when the main act was on and you filled the room with people, my God, Dinky, your sound system really was just amazing. When you had enough people in there to arrest some of those reflections, it sounded beautiful.
Yep.
It really did.
Did do that. That's the beauty of that system.
And anybody remember being there? I mean, the speaker columns weren't like, you know, you go to, some of these, the concerts, maybe the music tent here in Boston, you know, these are matched, manufactured, matched speaker sets. But Binky, what you had was, you know, gear that was tried and true throughout your whole history. And it was just very intimidating looking. Let's just say it like that. You have 15-inch bass speakers, like three or four of them. And then you had the mid-range, the 8-inch, and then you had your tweeters, your horns. And, again, when the club wasn't full, it was, you know, not as good. But when that club was full, it was really good. And, of course, anybody who's played there knows about the big blue amps.
Oh, yeah.
So
You worked on them. You worked on them.
You remember that, yeah.
Yeah,
so,
and every time they blew something up, you were out working before. I didn't have a Deckham to engineer because you became an engineer at that point, tech.
Yeah, well, you know, I started getting into the component level electronics,
yeah.
You know, with all of the trying to, you know, wire up my own home studio. But, you know, the blue amps, you know, what are they, like 500, you know, like 500 amps per channel, 500 watts a channel, something like that, something crazy.
It was about three to 400 a channel.
Three or four.
And they were blow. They were bigger than the Crowns at that time, the DC-300As and what have you. And they were just handmade, homemade, and there were 14 of them and stuff, what have you.
That's what I wanted to ask you. So you had 14 because, you had enough for driving everything. I think you did have some Crown amplifiers, the smaller ones for the
60s. The 60s were used for either a horns or separate. And then you worked with me at the Necco Place. You built that whole thing with me, and you wired it, and you put in the Crowns in there. That's the whole thing. It was a smaller rack to deal with because of the space that we had to deal with, and what have you.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I've got you photographs of you building that stuff with me inside. And doing that, but you went more electronics on, went to the tech side, and you were already doing the tech stuff, doing mending, you know, the cables here and there when things went down and what have you. But then then building out that whole Necco Place, it was your baby basically, because you tuned it and did everything the way that it should be. You put your heart and soul into it, and then not just you, but other engineers came in and just was simple, had a good time with it, you know. And that thing, I said to myself, Doug's got it going. You learn so fast, Doug. That's the thing that got me. I mean, it was so fast that you put stuff together. I mean, I know you had to because of the conditions that you were in, but it worked. It worked because you were smart enough to understand the simple stuff. And that's really what it's all at. It's simply, you know, a signal that comes from a mic that goes through into an amplifier to amplify it, and you just turn down, turn it up at the volume according to what's needed for that room and whatever. And then, you've mixed that. But also then you go into use your head and mix these monitors on stage. And I saw you, that's why I thought you'd do it on your own. You could run back and forth from the monitor board to the soundboard in the front and get it together. And at that stage, you were doing that. And you were learning how fast that was. And then working with the other engineers that came in and other guys that were like yourself but still didn't they were all admired you for doing the technical side and for showing them what to do and showing them this, that, and the other, even though they knew and up to a point, but they'll have them with, oh, right, that's a good lad. He knows what he's doing and what have you. So one question I want you to answer, if you can, is what show that really got you going? Is there any shows that really that you just blew your mind and couldn't believe how it worked out and stuff? Are there any there that you worked?
Yeah, so you know, when you think about things, there are snapshots, and you remember, you know, day after day, there's so many shows, and you know, there were, you know, really good shows and some shows that didn't go well. What would be my? I think that first show, the Extreme show, was really important for me for that to happen.
Yeah.
And for that to be successful, because it was the first time you let me on my own on a Saturday night, and you know, the place is packed, and I realized that I'm it. You know, I am. You know, if I just walked out, right, or if I, you know, just passed out or something like that, the whole thing would just come to an end, so, or to a stop.
Yeah.
And so that was a level of pressure on me, because, you know, I essentially by myself, except for whoever was, you know, on DJ for the night, and maybe there was a, you know, there would be a lighting guy, but that guy would be for, you know, Extreme or for whoever the headlining band was. So, you know, it was really contingent upon me to make sure it happened well. So, I have to give that show, and I remember Gary Cherone, the lead singer, this is when he was, you know, full, you know, big hair metal. I just have a recollection of he bent over and just looked at me. I was at the monitor board, so I was working the monitors for the show, and he gave me this glare, and I was, my heart's on going, oh my God, what's wrong? But it ended up just being, he was just doing his natural moves.
Yeah.
I don't know why that sticks with me, because through that whole night, you know, I was just like, oh, I can't mess up. No. But they put on a good show. One of the things, like, you know, in addition to the sound, you used to throw me other work, like that rack that I talked about. You used to, you know, when the band's writer would request sound gear, processing gear, you knew what I had. And it's like, Dougie, I can pretty much what I would make for the night, you would be able to pay me for just bringing down, I don't know, the Rev 7 or whatever I had. And, you know, you would give me the rental money for that year. And I really appreciated that and hospitality. Sometimes they needed somebody for hospitality. You give me a call, I'd go down and I would just work hospitality. So, you know, there was so many different facets. But the one show I can point out to you that you have sometimes, you know, you took all of the headlining acts, all of the national, international acts, you know, you took those because, you know, those are the main flagship shows. And, you know, you have to make sure that you be on site and they go well. But sometimes you'd call me to help you out. So I would work alongside you for those shows. And there was one particular show was Dickie Betts with Greg Allman.
There you go. Yeah.
So I was helping you on that show, but for some reason they had no lighting designer. So come walking over to me, Dougie, you want to do lights for this show? Like, what?
That's right.
And my only experience with lights was putting up, you know, on the new music nights, you know, I knew how to operate the board, and I would just, you know, whatever the standard that the lighting guy that, you know, the channel employed or whatever to do that maintenance of thing. I think maybe DB, David Byrne, do you remember?
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately, DB passed away a few last year.
Yeah, I heard about that. But, you know, that was my only experience. But so then, you know, you said, I could get you more money. I'm like, oh, wow. So, you know, I actually designed also. They had a conga player, bongo player in the corner. I remember spilling out a light for that. So, you know, my first time actually designing lighting, working between, you know, the sound check. But the one thing is, being inexperienced, I messed up. And what was the mess up was, like, Dickie Betts started the show because he was really the headliner. It was Dickie Betts with Greg Allman.
Yeah.
And the end of the first tune, I did a blackout. And the audio engineer, he's like, no blackouts. I'm like, get the lights up. But then I put the lights up and I'm like, oh, they don't like blackouts. Dickie Betts or Greg Allman, they don't like blackouts. So, you know, that stuck with me.
Okay. Well, you knew then. I didn't know they didn't like blackouts until you just said that.
Yeah, I mean, but and then afterwards I was kind of doing lighting changes because, again, I'm, you know, new at it, thinking I have to do something to make it, you know, happen. And he's like, no light changes. I'm like, oh, okay, just smooth scene changes.
Yeah.
And by the time, you know, midway through the set, everything calmed down. I was doing nice lighting changes and the sound engineer was happy with me. And that's one show that sticks in my mind. But, you know, there's so many shows that's, you know, there's, oh, others like John Messina, almost getting my butt kicked by John Messina.
I believe it.
Really good story. So John Messina, Michael's Messina band. John Messina always reminded me of like Jeff Skunk Baxter, but, you know, same kind of look, but bigger and taller. And I guess he had a reputation for this, but there was a Saturday night where they didn't come for a sound check. So, but I think they were like the first or second band. And so they just came in and we only have 15 minutes to change over.
Yeah.
And I got it all set up and they don't have anybody to mix sound. So I'm running back and forth between the house soundboard, which was, you know, as far as sound club's concerned, it might as well be a mile away.
Yeah.
It's a big venue. And I got to run back to the stage to make sure the monitors are good. So, I'm just going completely blind. The house is packed. And it sounds like crap. And this woman comes over to me, so, you know, older woman. And she's like, what are you doing? It sounds terrible. It sounds terrible. And I'm like, if you remember those times, you've got all of this sound level going on. And it's almost like operating a bomber in a bomb run during World War II. You've got flak from the ground. You've got, you know, fighter planes shooting at you. You've got intercom shouting at you. But you got this mission that you got to do. And it's that kind of mayhem. And I just snap back. It's like, well, if you came here for sound check, maybe this would be a problem. And I had no idea who she was. So, you know, after that show was over, changing over for the next band, before the next band stuff, this guy comes up to the monitor board, steps up the steps and comes right in my face. He's, you know, I'm what, 5'9", 5'8", 5'9", he's like 6'3", whatever. What did you say to my mother? I was like, oh boy.
My mother? Oh my God.
That was his mother.
Oh my God.
And I thought, man, I'm gonna end the night with a bloody nose and a black eye. So, you know, want to defuse the situation, don't need to escalate. It's like, all I said was like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know that was your mother. I was confused, I was working. It's like, and he immediately just like a switch, just stops like, oh, all right, that's all right. How do you do it? And he's shaking my hand and he was like a buddy. And so all he wanted was just a vent. And, you know, his mother went back to him. I guess I gave a curt answer to her for why the sound was bad. That's another one. I mean, it's just
that's hilarious. But that's the stuff that was happening all the time, though. I mean, weird
all
things
the time. The thing is, you shielded a lot of that from me. That's why I don't have any dirt. I mean, sometimes you would talk about it, and you would say, but, you know, you don't need to worry about it. I'm not, and I remember always thanking, he's like, thanks, Dickie. I don't need to hear that, you know. So, but sometimes you would allude and give me what was going on behind the scenes, none of which I remember anyway.
But going back and forth to the stage was a normal thing for anybody to do that's doing sound and production that night, basically. And until we had, you know, people coming in doing full production like myself for a while, or, you know, people like Scott Pillman and Timmy Hines, and they would do the production as well as running around, and you had learned all that. But also the technical side, you were keeping everything going with that side. I didn't know you got into the light thing, but that's cool. I like that one. I mean, that's one of the good stories.
So yeah, those are the things that you remember, like the good shows, you kind of just, okay, go on to the next day.
So, yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? So you don't really, you know, it's 39 years ago this month that I, you know, that I met you. So luckily I had a week to pull out the files from the deep in my head.
Now that's what that's why I'm glad I did do your text last week, because see, that does rack your brain after a while. You start looking, and if you go on to Boston's Best Live Rock, just as like I tell everybody to go on there and check out the shows. In other words, for every year there's a documentation of every show, and then you can go, oh well, that so and so played with so and so. I remember that now. It was, and then you get into it at that point because it's like. It rocks your brain, racks your brain and stuff, and say, I remember that one, and I remember, and with the shows that you were saying about the Extreme, I forgot you did done on Saturday night on Extreme, but you did a great job because the guys themselves have their own network of people doing sound and sometimes the lights and stuff that they have a great light guy now, Martin Favor, who is used to be there if you remember Martin.
I remember that's the name I was trying to think of just about an hour ago. He had a big black bushy mustache. He was a light guy.
Martin's still Extreme's lighting engineer. He went out and purchased a fully computer to be able to travel around the world with them and do, you know, hundreds of set of scenes. And so all he has to do is press the button and a certain scene comes up for the lighting, because today they've got all the movable lights. And so he can set all kinds of beautiful patterns for the particular songs and really work with the music, you know, and be creative with that. And he does a great job because umpteen of the metal bands, Slaughter and all these are the ones that came through. He's working with them too. When Extreme's not on and the other guys are out on the road, he'll go out with them and do that kind of stuff with a totally different scene set up. But he takes his laptop on there, there is put all his programming in, and sometimes he takes his board with him. But on the big stuff, like going to Europe and what have you, when he's doing all the big festivals with Extreme, he can walk into places, the big arenas, and set all the stuff up, and they can have an incredible show every time because of the lighting. And the sound is the same way. He doesn't go crazy, he just gives it Extreme sound. And okay. And they have this package going out that's really good, and a lot of those metal bands only play in Europe or Japan or somewhere like that. They don't really hit here unless it's a festival of some kind, you know. Uh-huh. And but there's still that same network of people still out there. The ones that Paul Hagar doing sound, he's doing Miley Cyrus plus umpteen other bands. Wow. Scott Perlman, remember Scott? He's out there doing stuff out of Nashville. Timmy Miller is working with I forget now. It's he's out on the West Coast working with not Rick James. I did Rick James and Rick's passed now. Him and his daughter, metal daughter and stuff, play and Will Smith. That's what I'm thinking of. And so he's doing all them kind of acts. Will Smith, he did, you know, New Kids. He did NSYNC for a while, the Disney acts and stuff, as I call them. And that kind of stuff where everybody's excelled and gone in there, but you went into the electronics after you got away from the sound stuff. I know that you went into doing electronics and gear and all kinds of stuff that you worked on, and that's the biggie. That's the biggie is because, you see, you've taken all that knowledge from all the craziness at the channel and all the past and stuff, and it's in your brain, but it goes, I can do this now. I can do that now. I've got that down. Well, let's challenge. Let's do this. And by the end of the day, you've achieved a lot. Look, you did an installation with me in New York City. And not only did the installation in this temple down there, it was so well done because it was using the same situation of what it was originally, the same areas where we put the speakers. We just did them 70-volt line and then and put them up in the same area, just the bowls, columns and stuff. And it, and with the QSC, it was in it, just those, that too worked wonderful. And they're really still at it with the same gear because it's been there. Wow.
You're kidding, really?
Well, it's because it, that kind of stuff will last forever if it's done right. You know, we, the speakers originally were not, you know, the destroyed on 74 line, but the bowls are set up to be able to do that professionally and for a long time, and they're still working. And I can't grumble at any of that stuff because that was really done in Temple on 100 Street. It was beautiful. Sound in there, they could speak and everyone could hear crystal clear instead of trying to look at sit in their seat and point the ears at themselves and say,
right,
where is it? But they hear it crystal clear without any noise. And that's what you did with me in there. And I was like,
I'm going to remember that. I remember that distinctly. Get up on ladders and hang in those speakers.
Oh, yeah.
The surround speakers and, you know.
Well, it's the same as Necco Place. You were hanging the damn speakers up there in Necco Place and we were pointing them to the left, to the right, so we had a good spread on them. The reason those speakers were done is that there were 10-inch woofers, which is acoustic suspension, and then there was the 4.5-inch, and they were mid-range, and then the Philips domes. Now, the whole thing about this system, it's nothing to do with PA. It's to do with music reproduction. It's a large hi-fi system, and that's where it was at. So you were mixing on the biggest stereo that there could have been, especially in the channel. And you were enjoying that because, wow, I can hear this piano playing really well. Well, now if I hear this, it feels so good to go with that drum there. And you can build a platform. You can build up the sound and stuff. And you were really good at that stuff because that's your knowledge of music and your knowledge of the keys, the knowledge of the sound. And that's the key to what you did, is learning all that stuff at Berkeley and learning all that stuff prior to that. And then the rest of it was just mechanical to flow into. You still was using your ears, Doug, on the systems, especially once you got used to what sound did come out of each speaker. And that was why that you and people like Scott and Paul Eager and all the good ones, and Timmy Hines unfortunately passed away, but Timmy Miller we still got, and just really quality. All of you had your own field on there. And then when you came along and did what was doing, I'm saying he can do electronics too. Oh, my goodness, he's excellent at wiring, excellent at this. Go for it, Doug, just do it. And I give you the freedom to be able to, whatever went down or the speaker blew or that went or whatever, you fixed them and no problem. And got everything back to ship shape and was being an engineer with no messing. You take it to the hilt. So one more story or two, and then we're going to have to call it off here, you know, because it's we have so much time we can only use and stuff, and which is good, because otherwise me and you would probably chat for 2 hours, which I've already told many people the same thing.
I hate to end it on a bad note, but you asked me about some of my favorite shows, memories, and yeah, I'll tell you about the worst show. How's that?
That sounds good. Yeah.
So it was another, I think it was a Tuesday. Tuesdays were typically not new music Mondays, but, maybe four bands. And if there was nothing national that they can book on a Tuesday, if they even would want to.
Yeah.
I think it was a Tuesday. But anyway, as you described, the sound system that you had at the channel, except for the house board, you know, the power amps, the monitor board, those were all, custom made. But the monitor board was, this project metal case, with a hinge for the front where all the knobs were. And one night, for some reason, I lost a monitor channel. So we typically, I think by default, we offered five channels and we could always add some more afterwards. But the monitors went out for these guys and I don't know. I think it was the first band. And I couldn't figure it out. And I'm switching cables out. The band is still playing. The singer's looking back at me like, you know, what's the status? I can't hear myself. And I went over with a cable. And in the back, there was really nothing labeled. Maybe there was, you know, a Sharpie, a black Sharpie on some of the plugs. So there's this XLR. It's like, well, maybe this is the output for another monitor channel that I can send to and use that, because maybe I got a channel down on the board. And boom, all of the monitors went. The board went down. Now nobody had monitors. Oh. I'm like, my God, what is happening? So it was the one time, and this is like, it'd be a nightmare scenario for me at the, because, you know, I want everything to go well. And I knew that those days, those Mondays, those Tuesdays, the new music nights, you know, one of the reasons why you took me on is because, you know, you're the owner of Dawson Sound Company. You've got a prestigious career going, spanning the 60s, you know, Birds, Fleetwood Mac, Steely Dan, Mahavishnu Orchestra. You were the first to mix out in the audience because, you know, in the time in England, they would just, you know, you would mix from the projection booth in the theater.
Oh, yeah.
So all of that stuff, you know, because I realized later on, it's like the last thing you want to do is, you know, work a new music night. And, you know, especially this kid with, you know, this plywood box that's going to, you know, need to be plugged into the board. And you just want to have an easy night. So I'm sure that added to your stress for me, you know, showing up with that. But, you know, that was your night off.
Yeah.
And I was at my, I had the whole night to get through, and I had no monitors. So I had to run to the office and call you up. Like, Dinky, everything's out. I don't know what happened. And you're living in Plymouth at the time. To get up to Boston, I don't know how you did it, but you were up here in like, you know, 25 minutes. I was shocked when you showed up, because when you showed up, you know, you the band had already finished. And you knew exactly, you come right in. I don't know if the band had finished yet. I'm not sure. Maybe they were still going. But you just, you didn't even ask anything. You just went right into the anvil case where all the microphones were, to the side of the backstage, walked right up, slipped the lid off the monitor board, and plugged in the fuses and powered it back on. And just, all right, you're all set. And then you left. I was like, I plugged in here. No, Dougie, that's not audio. That's power. So that was a combination of all the nightmares that I ever could conjure up thinking about working at that place for the 5 years. It's like, I don't want to completely, you know, stop the show dead in the water. That would be just like picking up and leaving. Right? So that's my worst show. And I think I shared this on Facebook a few years ago with you. And I just want to extend my apology to you. You know, I still feel bad to this day.
No, things like that happen. Hey, come on, I've plugged in things out that shouldn't be in places. But you learn. You learn from that. Oh, that's a power thing. That's not a regular audio. Oh, even though it's the same plug.
It's right. And then, of course, you've got the mayhem of the loud levels and everything going on around you. It's hard to, you know, block everything out.
Oh, yeah, totally. It's hard to do it. You can't focus because you can't just focus on that because everything else is going off around you. So I think I must have just come in and looked at the situation and went, well, okay.
No, you knew how to fix the problem immediately. But, you know, you got better at focusing in those environments. And you know it because
you're
the master of it.
Well, you did real well all the time. You did great with everyone was happy. I haven't heard any bad stuff from anybody over the years, you know, and that kind of thing about any one of us, you know, and every one of the people that worked the sound, even though there was bad nights here and bad nights there, but there was also great nights and great performances from all the people. And like I said, there was people like DB, Martin Favor, to help you along, and Musta Cami all over the torture as well. But that was okay. You learned all that.
Yeah. I think we can close with this. I just wanted to let you know, I mean, you know, you were a very influential part of my life at a young age. And, you know, you were very supportive. Like, this call reminds me of the calls that we used to have. Now, you call it. It wouldn't be. It would never be short. It would be like, you know, this is the schedule. You talk to me and like, how did it go? And I tell you, and you give me you know, solutions, words of encouragement. I remember the one thing that I impart on my children is I talk to them about you, and you know, the one thing I learned of all the things that I remember, the one thing that I you know, keep close to my heart and always remind myself. Because whenever I talk to you, Dickie, about the frustrations, this is what you would say. You'd say, Dougie, as long as you're okay on your end, that's all you have to worry about. Just make sure you're okay on your end and leave the rest to them. That's their problem.
Yeah, exactly.
As long as you're okay on your end, that's all you have to worry about. And it's so simple, but it really had... You have to do that way. But, you know, we'd have these conversations. You know, we'd be on the phone 15, 20 minutes talking about it. So, you know, it brings back a lot of memories. And it was great to talk to you again, Dickie.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you again, Dougie, for chatting about all the time and the respect and stuff of everybody and what you've done over the years and stuff and what have you. And we will end it by saying thank you, Doug Winicky, for this information and interview for Two Pints in the Corner. And this is Two Pints in the Corner saying to Doug, thank you again. And we calling out. We're closing down now. So thank you, Doug.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. I hope everyone enjoyed it.
Thank you.